Volkswagen, Boehner, the Pope, China, it's been a busy week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us this Friday, the 25th day of September. We're going to start the day like we do pretty much every Friday with the weekly wrap, a look back at the big stories of the week. I'm joined by Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Neela Richardson of Redfin. They're both in our studio in D.C. Hi.
Hi, Adrienne.
So let's start with the disastrous week for Volkswagen. Neela, just how bad is it for the company?
It's bad for the company. It's worse for the movement in terms of climate change and clean energy and having fuel-efficient cars. It's funny how the three major stories of this week kind of conflated around the climate and the environment, both the Chinese president's visit, the Pope's visit, and Volkswagen. And Volkswagen was the only negative story outlook. And it was negative because it was disappointing to so many of the believers of diesel and that, you know, they were buying into something that really didn't exist when it came to Volkswagen. And it kind of sheds doubt on other car companies who are trying to make those same efforts.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about climate later in the show. But Sudeep, I wonder what you think VW's trouble mean for Germany's economy. I saw one economist call it a bigger downside risk for the German economy than the Greek debt crisis. Is that possible?
It certainly could be. This is a company that is so embedded in not only the German economy, but the German culture. When so many people think of the German auto industry and the German manufacturing industry and what it stands for, they often think of Volkswagen. They think of everything that it's been through over its very long history. And that has been spread around the world, particularly throughout Europe and the United States. And now it's just upended so many assumptions people have. Everyone's, of course, wondering, can you even trust the company anymore? But can you trust all of the emission standards that we have? Can you trust all of this technology? And that's a lot for a single company and a single country to bear.
I want to move on to interest rates. Janet Yellen gave a speech yesterday reiterating that interest rates are likely to go up this year. And I wonder, Sudeep, why'd she feel the need to reassure the markets about her intentions?
There's so much confusion out there in the market about what's the Fed going to do. You can see the daily movements in the stock market and the bond market just based off of this. And the decision a week earlier about what the Fed did in its statement really pointed to a weak global economy and cast some doubt on whether the Fed would ever raise interest rates. And so Janet Yellen looked like she was trying to get ahead of that, saying, okay, well, yeah, well, you're still planning on raising interest rates this year if some of these other factors cooperate. She didn't completely make the sale to the public, but she got further in that direction to say, whoa, 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 don't get too excited that we're going to have zero rates forever because the first rate hike is coming. But there's probably still going to be some confusion out there.
And Neela, what difference do a few months make? Why not do it now if you look like you're going to do it in December?
Well, in normal times, the Fed raises rates when the economy overheats. And there's just nothing showing any kind of overheating going on, especially when it comes to wages. That's been the real sticker. The problem for the Fed is there's never going to be a good time to raise rates. In Washington, we're not only talking about a potential government shutdown in October, but also the debt ceiling debate coming up again. And so is that a good time to raise rates? And what's going to happen in December? The Fed has to make a stand, and they may have to make it at an inopportune time. And that's the hard part.
Now, we've got just about a minute left, so we're going to have to be fast here. But I wanted to get your take on the cyber agreement announced today between the U.S. and China. Neela, you go first.
Well, I find it great that the Chinese president went to Seattle first before Washington, D.C., because he knows where the power is in the United States is with the tech industry. Look, you know, the U.S., the president of China said it himself, the U.S. has the biggest technology when it comes to the Internet, and the Chinese have the biggest audience. So there should be this natural pairing, but there is instead a lot of distrust. And so hopefully this agreement will be a little bit of a step forward.
And Sudeep, what do you think? Is this actually going to change anything?
It's probably not going to change a whole lot. This is one of the most important and unusual bilateral relationships in the world between the U.S. and China. It's two enormous economies and militaries, and they seem to talk past each other at just about every turn. Now they've got a handshake to not pursue cyber attacks for economic purposes, but that leaves a whole lot on the table, and there's a lot of wiggle room in the agreement that they just had for both sides to come out of it and say that they're holding to their agreement, but you're gonna find that we're probably gonna be disappointed in the end.
Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal and Neela Richardson of Redfin, thank you both.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
On Wall Street Today, it was green, then red, then green. Then we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The surprise of the day, at least in the nation's capital, was the abrupt announcement by Republican John Boehner that he's going to resign his seat in Congress next month, and in doing so, end his term as Speaker of the House. His term as Speaker was marked by sharp disagreements with members of his own party, disagreements including the GOP's relationship with business and corporate interests. Turns out that relationship's been changing for longer than you might think. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
The relationship between business and the GOP right now is strained, and
that strain is real.
Douglas Holtz Aiken was chief economic advisor in John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. He now heads the American Action Forum think tank.
There is certainly a frustration among those like the Chamber of Commerce that some things they view as very simple and fundamental don't get done.
Things like a new highway bill, reauthorization of the Export-Import Bank. Holtz Aiken says the GOP business relationship started to deteriorate after a wave of Tea Party members was elected to Congress in 2010. They wanted to focus more on social issues. Other Washington watchers say it's more complicated than that.
It is very much nuanced, yes.
That's Bruce Bartlett, a senior policy analyst in the Reagan administration. He says a split developed in the business community starting in the 1970s between big business and small entrepreneurial businesses.
Since the rise of the Tea Party, that distribution of influence and power has shifted more back towards the smaller business sector.
How can big business claw back some influence in the GOP? With money, of course, at least according to Gregory Walrow, a professor of political science at Columbia University. His advice? Pour money into the primaries to help establishment candidates.
Coming to their aid if they face the Tea Party challenge in the primary, I think would help reassure establishment Republicans.
Who might actually get around to passing a highway bill. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Like we mentioned a minute ago up in the wrap, the world's two biggest emitters of carbon took a big step today toward addressing climate change. In a joint announcement, China and the U.S. outlined new steps to cut greenhouse gas emissions. And we're going to focus on just a piece of that news. Chinese President Xi Jinping confirmed plans to launch a national cap-and-trade system for carbon dioxide emissions. It would create the world's largest carbon market. In setting it up, China has a successful cap-and-trade model to study, the United States. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
In June 1989, President George H.W. Bush proposed a new Clean Air Act. It would cut sulfur dioxide emissions that caused acid rain by imposing an overall cap.
We're allowing utilities to trade credits among themselves for reductions they make to let them decide how to bring aggregate emissions down as cost-effectively as possible.
A power plant that cut its emissions more than required could sell credits to one that couldn't or wouldn't meet the limits.
It was a big experiment. No one had really done it, certainly on that scale before.
That's Robert Stowe, executive director of the Harvard Environmental Economics Program. The experiment worked. Fred Krupp is president of the Environmental Defense Fund, which helped develop the program.
The country has now reduced emissions by over 70%, and just at a fraction of the cost that was estimated.
Krupp's group has advised China as it applies that same approach to planet-warming carbon emissions in 7 regional pilot programs. David Wasko directs the Climate Action Initiative at the World Resources Institute. He says as China's cap-and-trade system goes national, it's critical to set overall emissions allowances at the right level if power plants and factories can buy credits too cheaply.
The incentives throughout the market to put in place low-carbon approaches will not be what one would hope for.
That's what happened initially in Europe's decade-old cap-and-trade scheme. But Wasko says the EU has taken steps to bolster the market, and the cap has worked. Carbon emissions have fallen. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Sunny Spain has put many of its European partners in the shade. After a deep recession, the Spanish economy is now the fastest growing in the Eurozone. But there's a pretty significant cloud on the Spanish horizon. This weekend, voters in the country's most prosperous region, Catalonia, go to the polls. They're electing a new local government. But many see the poll as a vote for independence, which could eventually lead to the breakup of Spain. From the Catalan capital, Barcelona, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Up to 1 million Catalans gathered in Barcelona recently to celebrate their national day and demand their voice be heard. The call for independence has swelled since Spain's economic crisis sent unemployment soaring and forced the central government to cut its budget. Teacher Daniel Guillamon says Catalonia now picks up the tab for the rest of the country.
We pay a lot more taxes than the money that the government spends here. So if we had all the money that we pay, we would be able to do many more things, especially education, health.
Que somos catalans!
Usted, governants!
But money isn't the only driver. Marta Vays, another teacher, says language and identity are also fueling the demand for Catalonian independence.
We are Catalan, no, we are not Spanish. We speak Catalan, we live in Catalonia, and I can't think about Spain. I only think about Catalonia.
Sunday's poll isn't a formal referendum on seceding from Spain. It's a parliamentary election for the regional government. But the current regional president says if pro-independence parties win, he'll push ahead with a plan to separate. Quite right, too, says Jordi Manya, professor of law at Barcelona University.
They haven't allowed us to have a referendum, so we have to use the only legal tool we have to express our feelings about independence.
He accepts that the national government in Madrid will not tolerate any move towards a separate Catalonian state.
They will declare our parliament probably illegal.
And that doesn't worry you as a professor of law?
Not very much, because I strongly believe that democracy is the first law.
A major constitutional clash is possible. Upholding the law, the national government could order the arrest of the independence leaders. The army might even be deployed. Unsurprisingly, business is getting nervous. This printing firm on the outskirts of Barcelona almost went bust in the recession. Now the economy is recovering fast, and so is the company. But the boss, Mateo Butzi, is now fretting about the potential fallout from Sunday's election.
This is what we don't need. Now we are starting to grow. Spain is growing. And the last thing that we want to put is more uncertainty into the system.
And Carlos Rivadulla, a Catalonian entrepreneur, says the overwhelming majority of business people in this region are happy to remain in Spain.
50% of the exports of Catalonia go to the rest of Spain. That's 40 million people, and I don't think any reasonable businessman wants to break an internal market that gives us so much.
300 miles away in the Spanish capital, Madrid, here in Retiro Park, people enjoy free music as they stroll in the early autumn sun. The atmosphere is very relaxed. But don't get the people of Madrid started on the subject of Catalonian independence. Jonathan Harosh is a freelance artist working in the park.
If they want to take Catalonia, they have to pay to buy it from the Spanish government. It belongs to the Spanish government. They have to pay for it. Each meter, let's say 50,000 euro for each meter. Then they will talk.
Tough talk, and we can expect more if the pro-independence parties win in Catalonia on Sunday. In Madrid, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up?
It's basic fairness. It's something that you learn in kindergarten. If you're playing a game, everybody who's playing the game should play by the same rules.
The difference between kindergarten and the real world? In the real world, someone's making a profit. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 113.7% to close at 16,314. The Nasdaq was off 47.1% to finish at 4686. The S&P 500 was down just a hair, basically flat at 1931. For the week, the Dow fell 0.4%. The Nasdaq gave back 2.9%. The S&P dropped 1.4%. Some corporate news. Nike says it's growing in China faster than expected. Shares in the company jumped nearly 9%. Its competitor, Under Armour, also saw an increase today, up about 1.5%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.16%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Pope Francis is wrapping up his visit to the U.S. Today, he addressed the United Nations in New York and had a lot of things to say about the global economy, how things work and how things should work. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson was at the U.N. for the speech and joins us now. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Adrienne.
So what kind of economic system does the Pope envision?
So one of the first things he mentioned was wanting all countries to have a more equal role in the financial agencies and groups that deal with economic crises. He said that would help limit abuses and make sure countries aren't subject to oppressive lending systems, systems that he says don't promote growth or progress, but which create greater poverty. And interestingly, he actually used the word usury here, which is a sin in the Catholic Church. And then he moved on to talk about rights to lodging, to labor, to land, a nice alliteration there. And he again focused on the environment. We've reported about that focus on climate change a lot this week. Today, he framed those environmental issues in the context of, quote, a selfish and boundless thirst for power and material prosperity. And he also talked about a culture of waste.
So we hear him talk about the environment, consumption, poverty, inequality, and it can sound like a pretty scathing critique of capitalism and even the U.S. economy. Do you read it that way?
I do think it's fair to say that what he's calling for is a pretty substantial overhaul to our global economic system. But I also think that a lot of his popularity is due to the fact that he's trying to tackle these really tough economic issues. Obviously, as the leader of 1.2 billion Catholics, he has a pretty powerful platform, but he also has the attention of non-Catholics as well, in a way that maybe past popes haven't. As evidence of that, I have this piece of tape that I am dying to play for you here. This is Dalila Ben-Mahidi. She's a worker at the UN, and she entered a lottery to be able to see the Pope as he passed through the halls.
I was praying to Allah to get a ticket to go see the Pope. I was actually praying in a Muslim way to Allah to say, please give me a ticket to see the Pope.
I think that perfectly sums up his appeal. It's not just Catholics who are interested in what he has to say.
So a lot of what he's talking about is a long way from sort of where we are living today, sort of our economic reality. What's actually in his power to change?
Right. I think the Pope Francis, he often gets really specific when he's advocating for certain ideas or policies. So, for example, he came out in favor of this UN resolution to create a formal bankruptcy system for countries. And he, again, talked about those sovereign debt issues today. But you're right. A lot of the things he does advocate for are these much bigger ideas, harder to realize. Like, for example, a shift to a less consumption-driven form of capitalism. Could he actually make that happen? Probably not in its entirety, but might he inspire some shift in consumption habits? It's possible.
And we're talking about it, right?
And we're talking about it, exactly.
Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, thanks.
Thanks, Adrian.
Not the greatest time to be a traditional taxi driver, which is probably a bit of an understatement. Ride-sharing companies like Uber are remaking the industry. Cab drivers are getting fewer fares. Some want to get out of the business altogether, but can't. They're locked in by what was once considered a safe investment, the taxi medallion. Sam Harnett reports.
Taxi driver Habir Bhatt has been working in San Francisco for over 20 years, but he says he doesn't want to do it anymore. His son's in college, and he has a young daughter to support. He says there are too many Ubers, Lyfts, and other unregulated cars for him to make a decent living.
There's not enough money coming at home, and I don't see any future income getting better.
I'm riding in Bhatt's cab. He's from India and built his life driving a taxi. 3 years ago, he bought a medallion. It's the license to operate a cab. Owning a medallion used to be the dream for taxi drivers. It made you an entrepreneur. You could drive when you wanted or rent the license out. But medallions were hard to obtain. They cost $250,000 a pop in San Francisco, and there was over a 10-year waiting list. Bhatt had to scrape together money to take out the loan for one.
Well, it's very hard, you know, like it was a little money I had, and I bought it from friends and all and family.
Bhatt's dream of owning a medallion has since become a nightmare. That's because companies without medallions, like Uber and Lyft, have flooded the streets. Bhatt wants to get rid of his medallion, but now buyers are so scarce, there is a waiting list to sell. It could take 4 years, Bhatt was told. That means 4 years of making payments on his $250,000 medallion while earning less and less from doing his job.
Where are you headed?
120 High Street.
It's a tricky place to get out from here.
Medallions are a way to regulate the number of cabs on the road. Many major cities use them. New York, Boston, Chicago. And for years, they were a great investment. Some cities allowed them to be traded in a secondary market, and their prices soared. In New York City, they were going for more than $1 million apiece.
All that changed with Uber.
Jay Hickman is an investor. He and others have positioned themselves to make money if medallion prices keep falling. In New York City, the value of a medallion has already dropped several $100,000.
Yeah, I think the medallion is going the way of the typewriter.
To fight back, the taxi industry is trying to sue Uber and city governments. Lawyer Edward Feldman is leading a lawsuit against Chicago.
Overnight, they flipped a switch and changed the rules, and they essentially destroyed the medallion.
A U.S. district court in Illinois ruled this week partly in favor of taxis. The court rejected some taxi driver claims, but says it's unfair to regulate taxis and Ubers differently because the two provide essentially the same service. Duh, says Feldman.
It's basic fairness. It's something that you learn in kindergarten. If you're playing a game, everybody who's playing the game should play by the same rules.
Uber's position is that it merits different regulations because of its technology, basically hailing a ride with an app instead of a hand. Uber didn't make anybody available to interview for this story. In an email, Uber spokeswoman Natalia Montalvo says that medallions restrict competition and aren't great for consumers. Those are points cab driver Habir Bhatt debates. He doesn't think medallions are perfect, but they are part of the regulatory system he had to work with. And he says he played by the rules.
We put our lives, pretty much all our lives, into this career, and nobody seems to give a damn about it.
Bhatt says he's got no choice but to keep driving. He has to continue making payments on that medallion. It's right up there on his dashboard, a little metal plate that stares him in the face every time he gets behind the wheel. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
This final note. In our editorial meeting this morning, our colleague at the BBC mentioned that North Sea cod was back on the menu. The cod population has started to recover after decades of overfishing. Apparently, Brits have been suffering through meals of subpar haddock and chips. The news got our foreign editor, John Buckley, thinking about the economic value of a fish and a pretty fascinating piece of history.
The Cod Wars.
The Cod Wars were basically a series of disputes between Iceland and Britain over fishing rights. At some point, the Brits sent in Royal Navy warships to protect their fishermen. The Icelandic Coast Guard cut the nets of British trawlers all over cod.
There's bound to be animosity because cod was the essential element of fish and chips. The fish traditionally was cod. So don't threaten fish and chips if you want to keep peace with the Brits.
But really, is fish and chips from cod that much better than fish and chips made with haddock?
Oh, it's night and day. Cod is it. Now, I'll probably get complaints from the Haddock Council or whatever, but frankly, that's the truth.
That's our very own John Buckley. That's it. We gotta go. Today, the Dow gained 113.7%. The Nasdaq was off 47.1%. And the S&P 500 was down the tiniest bit. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Adrian Hill. Kai's back Monday. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.